Can you hear me okay? I have a booming voice, so please let me know if it's overwhelming. Before I start, I want to acknowledge Ruth Malone, who co-authored this, what's now going to become a paper in the American Journal of Public Health in December under the Health Policy and Ethics Forum. She's been a wonderful mentor for me, and she is the professor and vice chair of the Department of Social and Behavioral Sciences at the School of Nursing at the University of California in San Francisco. So I have no relationships to disclose. So just to let you know what I'm going to be talking about today, the significance of secondhand smoke, I think I'm preaching to the choir here. I want to talk a little bit about the current policies, both public and private. And I want to talk a little bit about legal precedents with regard to protecting children in private arenas. There have been some rulings in the family courts over the past decade that are significant. And then I'm going to go into a principlist ethical analysis of why secondhand smoke regulation may be justified. Principlist ethics include four main principles: autonomy, non-maleficence, justice, and beneficence. And I'll go into that in more detail later. So just some background, and again, I'm going to go over this quickly because I think you all know this. Secondhand smoke includes both mainstream and sidestream smoke. There's more than 50 carcinogens. It's about four times more toxic than mainstream smoke alone. And in 2005, the California Air Resources Board named secondhand smoke as a toxic air contaminant. And over a decade ago, the EPA classified secondhand smoke as a Class A human carcinogen. So the significance of secondhand smoke in children is 22% of children under the age of 18 lives with a smoker, and it's estimated that about half of children under the age of 5 are affected by secondhand smoke in the home. And as has already been pointed out, there's more deleterious effects in children. There's a higher incidence of SIDS, otitis media, bronchitis, asthma, pneumonia. There's lower respiratory infections that are increased, and there's slower lung development, both in utero and once they're born. And the medical costs to treat secondhand smoke infections in children are estimated to be about $4.6 billion per year. And there's more missed days of school for those children who live with smokers. So we know that there's quite a bit of policy in public spaces, starting with Minnesota in 1975. And by 1999, all 50 states had some degree of restriction, including D.C. And as of this month when I checked, about 23 states had comprehensive smoke-free laws, meaning including the workplace, restaurants, and bars. The policy in private spaces are not quite as overwhelming. Cars have been addressed, and as we've just learned about, there's reasons to restrict secondhand smoke or secondhand smoke in cars. And smoking a cigarette for just 5 minutes in a car can prove harmful to children. And there are laws in effect in several states. The type of law varies according to the state. In some states, children are protected only while they're in car seats, whereas in other states, the laws are in effect until the age of 18. So now that leaves the home, which is now the primary place for secondhand smoke exposure. Homes remain largely unregulated, and we know that smaller children, which are really the more vulnerable population, spend the most time at home. They're closer to their parents, and they're not able to leave their environment. And in 2006, Dr. Carmona suggested that we have voluntary adherence to smoking restrictions in the home. So just to give you an idea of some policy that I found, in 2004, Oklahoma passed an amendment to an existing custody law that indicated that children needed to be protected from foreseeable risk of harm. And the author's intention of this was to actually cover secondhand smoke in the home. It was a groundbreaking idea. But unfortunately, to date, there's still not much enforcement in this area, at least in non-foster care settings. Foster care homes do have more protection, both in Oklahoma and in other states. And there are some ordinances being passed in different cities, such as Belmont, California, that restrict smoking in multi-unit housing. So I'd like to talk a little bit about family court rulings that are significant to this topic. In 1994, there was a custody decision that was based solely, there was a reversal of a custody decision based solely on the fact that one of the parents smoked. And this demonstrated that secondhand smoke exposure could be used as a factor in determining a child's health, safety, and welfare in the courts. And then there was Jonita versus David, and this was the first to consider a healthy child's request to be in a smoke-free environment. Prior to this, all of the children were having chronic health problems such as bronchitis or asthma, but this was a healthy child who did not want to be in a smoking home. So Jonita, I'm going to have to look it up. It's one of them is the New York Supreme Court, and one of them is the Ohio State Court. Yeah, the Jonita versus David is the New York Supreme Court, sorry. The New York Supreme Court determined that children have the right to be in a smoke-free environment. And the last one I'd like to point out is Reed Julianne, which was the Ohio District. And this child was actually being exposed in both homes, and the judge took it upon himself to look at the literature on secondhand smoke. This wasn't brought up by one of the parents. And it led to a thorough review of the secondhand smoke literature, and he actually concluded that family courts do have a duty to protect children from secondhand smoke. So in summary, with the family courts, the role of the family court is to advocate for a child's best interest. They've been receptive to ruling on secondhand smoke exposure when chronic illness is involved, and it does remain less defined when chronic illness is not involved. However, based on the last case that I mentioned, there is definitely an open door. So now I'd like to switch gears and talk about the ethical analysis now that you have some background on why we feel that this is a justified discussion. So just to give you some background on ethics, when you're posed with a conundrum, it's helpful to use a framework of decision-making. And ethical decision-making is a way for you to kind of systematically go through the problems and try to lay it out in an objective fashion. And the four main principles in principlist ethics include autonomy, non-maleficence, beneficence, and justice. And principlist ethics are derived from a common morality. It's our desire to do good ultimately in society. Yet it still allows room for judgment in specific cases. So with this analysis, Dr. Malone and I wanted to examine the issue of secondhand smoke in private arenas. And we wanted to focus on all adults, not only parents, the example of children being exposed in the home, not just by their parents, but other adults that they're living with. It's important that we're not just focusing on parents. The reason we want to do this is because all adults in society have a minimum weak moral obligation to protect children. And they have a strong moral obligation to avoid harming children. So we came up with three policy alternatives. One was to act to restrict smoking in the presence of children. Two was to force adults who smoke in the presence of children into a cessation program. And three was to just take no action. So I'd like to first talk about autonomy. Autonomy oftentimes comes up when you talk about regulation of this kind, where you're actually looking at imposing a regulation that feels like a breach of the 14th Amendment. And it's helpful to know what autonomy is, what the actual definition is. And so it's helpful to ask of an adult smoker, is this person acting with intention, understanding, and without being influenced by a controlling agent? And if you answer yes, they do know what they're doing, they understand and they're intending to do what they do and they're not being influenced by a controlling agent, it actually suggests more of a malicious decision by the adult and really leads us to think that regulation is indicated. The reason for this is children are vulnerable and they're not able to act on their own, and so they need regulatory protection. However, if you can argue that the person isn't truly autonomous, that they're not acting with intention or understanding, and they are being influenced by a controlling agent, Then you can argue that it's possible that adult-focused education, in addition or instead of regulation, might be just as helpful. One example is if there is a parent who really truly believes that smoking in a different room is sufficient in protecting their child against secondhand smoke exposure, it could very well be that all they need is more education for them to make the behavior change on their own. We also wanted to propose that nicotine is a controlling influence. Typically, in this ethical analysis, using this definition of autonomy, the influence is usually a human, but we wanted to argue that nicotine is actually a controlling influence on its own and can affect a smoker's ability to be autonomous. So now I'd like to talk about non-maleficence, which is to do no harm. I think we all can agree that parenting and caring for children requires non-maleficence. And based on what we know about secondhand smoke, restricting smoking in spaces where children are present is an act of non-maleficence. And therefore, the issue of secondhand smoke exposure in the home juxtaposes an adult's autonomy to smoke with the duty to do no harm. And now let's talk about beneficence, which is the act of doing good. And the difference between non-maleficence and beneficence really hinges on the intended action. So non-maleficence obligates to do no harm, and beneficence implies this and the intention to actively do good. An example is non-maleficence is to, you know, don't hit your kid. And beneficence is vaccinate your kid or give your kid praise. So paternalism can be seen as falsely beneficent and a breach of autonomy. And this is an example when someone who thinks they know better than you decides what's good for you. And a lot of regulation can be seen as paternalistic. Seatbelt laws have been accused of being paternalistic, and motorcycle helmet laws as well have been accused as being paternalistic. And something like secondhand smoking in the home could also be seen as paternalistic. Finally, justice. Justice is the concept that society has a duty to address all forms of social disadvantage. We know, based on current policy, that there's inequities between adult and children in existing protections of secondhand smoke exposure. In addition, there's increased concentrations of secondhand smoke among those who experience multiple social inequities, so those who are of lower socioeconomic status or lower education levels and minority populations. So when doing an ethical analysis, it's helpful to balance the principles. It's actually a requirement. And it's required also that you give equal weight as much as possible to each of the principles. So we, during the balancing of the principles, came up with these thoughts, that adults have a non-maleficent duty to protect children, which I've said before. And although secondhand smoke regulation may impinge on adult autonomy, the duty to non-maleficence and the principle of justice trumps this. And a breach of autonomy really is temporary and intermittent for the adult, whereas the effects of secondhand smoke are lifelong. In addition, one could argue that the breach of autonomy really is a moot point if the person that is smoking doesn't truly meet the definition of authentic autonomy. However, we feel that forcing an adult to stop smoking as a way to restrict secondhand smoke would be considered a breach of autonomy. So in conclusion, we're recommending that, or we feel that policy restricting secondhand smoke exposure in private areas is ethically justifiable using a principlist analysis. But in addition, secondhand smoke exposure needs to continue to be an intervention priority, or begin to be an intervention priority, in pediatric and public health settings, and also in community-based organizations. And adult-focused education interventions to decrease secondhand smoke exposure in children that both support adults' innate desire for non-maleficence and address cessation based on readiness to quit may actually assist with restoration of what we call authentic autonomy and is a truly beneficent and non-paternalistic act by a provider. Thank you.
We have time for some questions or comments from folks. Stand up and identify yourself, please.
I agree it does have some transferability, and it was a huge coup to see that, and I've seen it at the Westin too, when I open up one of the papers and it says, you can breathe freely here, that they have now made it a smoke-free environment in all of the rooms. I think in the early days when we were still trying to get at what those costs really were, I think the reason that you're going to see a lower cost in hotel rooms is even though you have a smaller space and you have walls and carpeting, in many of the apartment complexes, you're also talking about the cabinetry that has to be done and larger spaces that have to be remediated. So if you're talking a two-bedroom apartment with a kitchen space, you're talking about an extensive cost to remove that. One person indicated that in one of the apartments, they had to totally redo all of the cabinets because when they came in, the tar was everywhere. The whole room was, you usually get like the basic building white when you go into an apartment. The room was yellow from all the tar that had just accumulated over a period of time. So they had extensive costs in taking that and just rebuilding it from the ground up. Plus, one of the other things in apartment complexes is oftentimes you have not just shared living spaces, but shared ventilation systems. So what goes into one apartment is sucked in and can be spread to other apartments as well.
Unfortunately, we don't, because when we give them, we have a passive air monitor, but we are, another one of our studies is rental car studies, and that is an active air monitor. So hopefully that might give us an indication of when the off-gassing is occurring, but for this study, I don't have any data, unfortunately. All I have are from previous studies by Daisy and saying it could be any couple of hours to days that it can occur. So my understanding about off-gassing is a state of equilibrium between what's absorbed into the surface and the concentration in the air. So if there's not enough contamination, nicotine in the air, then it will off-gas to the air, and so it'll kind of be a cycle going back and forth between the surface and the air. But unfortunately, from the data that we have, we don't have that kind of information.
Presentation 2 days ago, but if you give me your card, I can give you the data on that. What we've seen there is that about a third of the families that we've been working with, the smoker in the home has quit smoking, and I think 72% have developed smoke-free home policies, and that's at 3 months. But I can, if you give me your card, I can send you the information.
I have a question, Dr. Press. In terms of the
we've been working with both private and public, and at this point we're talking only about voluntary. We're looking at more writing it into the lease, so in terms of a more organizational, it's more at the manager level and the individual multi-housing unit. We thought it would be much more, in the areas that we've been working in, there's a lot of building unlike other areas. We have building coming in quite often. And so we wanted to take it beyond just the individual, whether it's public or private, that all housing that gets built has to have that condition as a part of being issued a building permit. But we've worked closely with our Section 8 housing, and we've had some very favorable results from them in voluntarily accepting the policy and writing it in. And the one that said that they could just write the 3-day notice and do the eviction, that was one of our Section 8 housing. So.
One of the other things you mentioned as a response from one of your participants was that there was concern about losing tenants in public
yes.
housing. And I guess I'm curious to know whether there's any evidence of having that
no,
at all.
No, there's been no evictions of people who are already existing who have a contract with the housing. This is being expected to be phased in so that as new apartments are rented, that this is now being put into the contract that they sign without going back to retroactively change existing contracts that they have.
Any other questions?
I'm not sure that we have data about that, but I know in California that the culture and the norms has changed so that more and more people are actually, although in the homes, they're not legally bound to have smoking bans, that more and more people are actually showing that they apply the smoking bans into the cars. But as far as the data that I've looked at, we really don't have any data or information about what we can do to tell people that, you know, I guess policy implication stuff. It's such a new stage. Like I really don't know that many people who do this, and I'm glad that people are interested because I think there are some implications, as we've seen all the panelists talk about exposure and how to minimize that. But we're so new and at the very beginning of this research that I'm sorry I can't answer that. But maybe we can have I think Jill might have a comment for you.
I don't have a specific comment. I can yell. You know, I think that the idea behind regulation in private areas such as cars and homes, they rely on principles similar to the policies in secondhand smoking in public areas where, you know, the enforcement of such regulation is really impossible, and you really are relying on social norm change to make this work. And so with regard to cars, I know in California it just started in January, so I don't know if anything really is being looked at in terms of the success rate. But I think for the most part we're looking, you know, not so much on enforcement as just relying on the social norm change that we saw in the public.
Literally, like, you get a mayor in San Francisco who made the health
would just tell you that in multi-unit housing, it's not necessarily one person's behavior that they can keep into their own home. That when you look at shared ventilation and shared living spaces outside of just that apartment, and the ability of the particulate to permeate into other apartments as well, now you're causing harm on other people. And so for us, that's where the issue begins to make the crux. If it was just your private home and your decision, that would be a very different space. In the case of our senior housing, we just surveyed over 400 senior residents, and there were a number of people very concerned about older people on oxygen smoking while they're on their oxygen tanks. Now, that's a concern to the entire community, because if one apartment blows up, they take everybody else with them. So, again, we're not in the same space that we're talking about one individual's behavior not impacting other people.
I just also wanted to comment that I think it's really important that we think about the fact that vulnerable populations are often those who don't have access to the services to change the behavior that they may actually want to change. I know in San Francisco there's very few services available for homeless people, for example, that want to stop smoking. So it might be that these people that you're worried about alienating really need more services directed towards them to meet them where they're at and see what they can do to change their behavior and provide more supportive services in that direction.
One of the other questions that I wanted to ask really is what any of you think are the most important unanswered research questions in this domain about exposure in private places, whether it's homes, cars, multi-unit housing. That's something that we at NCI are particularly interested in, is the unanswered research questions in this domain. I know you'll have plenty of answers.
Yes, it does. And I would concur with that, because having solid data when you're going to people and asking either for policy decisions to be made or individual decisions within a home environment, having good data is so critical. I had to dig through EPA data when we were working on the multi-unit housing about just the tot lot laws here. So if we have somebody smoking outside, what does that mean to the children in the complex? And it took a while to find the data that shows the hand-to-mouth exposure and the levels of those exposures as well. So it makes it a much easier basis to go and ask for that.
Yeah, one of our studies, actually, we went out to homes. So we did the same thing. We had the HSV-4 is a vacuum. It's a high-speed vacuum. And for that, we sift the dust. So that's one. So that's the dust on the floor. The surface wipes, we just use a template. So every car that we measured or every house that we measured, we're measuring the same area, but we use cotton that's not contaminated by nicotine, because believe it or not, we've bought cotton that has been contaminated. And so that we wetted that with 1 milliliter of, I think, about 10% or 1% of ascorbic acid. And then for the air, we have a passive monitor that we attach behind the rear view mirror. But for the rental car study, we're using an active monitor. So we stick this monitor that like sucks up the air onto the back seat of the onto the seat of the driver's car, and for 18 hours it just runs and it you know gets all the air inside of the car. So there are ways that you can measure contamination. It just yeah. And those are the three that we've been using for all of the cities. And we are actually now in the realm of hotels. So the next step for us is to go into hotels and collect the same data using the same measures. So I'm pretty sure you can use those same measures in a multi-unit housing study. For that analysis, we did account for model, the make, the year, and the mileage. And despite all of those variables, we still saw that the significant difference in resale value. So I'm not sure. I mean, I did hear that an article I read that a few years ago people were asking about homes. You know, so did somebody smell smoke in this home? And I'm not sure if there's any data to support that homes are being sold at you know, at less value. Probably not a good time to bring that up now in this economy, but as oh, that's great. That would be great.
Well, the other thing we know that there's a significant cost to basically to cleaning and
yeah.
Preparing a place for sale. So
yeah.
Whether that factors into the ultimate cost, at yeah. Some level it is going to be.
Because in cars, you can't remove the dashboard
exactly.
And the upholstery.
Exactly.
Yeah.
check on that. Because I would be more than happy to pay the extra check and help the additional caucus.
Yes, San Diego State University approved our research to recruit participants from them. Since they were selling their cars, then yeah, we achieved everything was random, but we saw them.
We give you $30 check.
Yeah. Yeah, and so, yeah, for all of our studies, we have to make that.
Thank you.
Don't talk to them about it, because
smokers have quit.
I know, that's true.
So it's nice to have the modeling behavior as well.